literally the first talk I walked into, which was the very end of this talk by this, he's a biohacker, and he had a man up on stage. The man was, you can imagine, looking very stoic as this man just injected something into his hand. And I believe it was something to do with NFTs, which feels a little wild in 2026, or something that you can open doors. I really wasn't sure, but I thought, okay, we're in for an interesting ride.
Welcome to the Heist Podcast. I'm Benjamin Stoller. Today is a conversation with me and Lily Johnston, a writer in Berlin. We commissioned her to write about the Trip Expo, which happened here in Berlin from the 15th to the 17th of May at Funkhaus. You can find her whole feature on heistberlin.com, and I will put a link there in the show notes for sure. The Trip Expo was billed as Europe's biggest event for psychedelic science and quote-unquote human flourishing. According to its website, it had 15,000 visitors, so it was a big event and maybe even a big success. I spoke with Lily about her time there. It seems like quite a wild time. There was drumming, there was biohacking, there were lots of drugs, there was partying. But yeah, what are the wider implications of this human flourishing expo in Berlin? Is it on brand for Berlin? Berlin has definitely had an alternative and rather druggy reputation, but it also has something in common with the expo's commercial focus and the many vendors that were there selling something beyond the healing properties of a psychedelic, let's say. So what does it mean when subculture becomes the culture, for example? And before I play the tape, I want to remind everyone that every contribution to us here at Heist helps us extend our cash runway and survive longer. So if you can, please consider becoming an apprentice for $90 a year or €9 a month, or just sign up at heistberlin.com for free if you haven't yet. All right, here's me and Lily Johnston.
Hi, I'm Lily. I'm a journalist from the UK and I live in Berlin. And this is the first feature that I've written for Heist.
Amazing. So what do you remember? Like, what were your main impressions? What was the vibe like? Paint the picture a little bit. Capture the atmosphere for people who maybe didn't read the article or weren't there.
Yeah, I mean, going into it, looking at the website in advance, it was this very strange combination of trying to be quite professional, but then something just being slightly off. And in advance, I was looking at this and thinking, okay, this is going to be a bunch of sort of biohackers, supplement grifters, people who think, you know, you can cure cancer by taking mushrooms or whatever. And those people were certainly there, but it was more of a complex experience than I'd sort of initially predicted. But yeah, stepping through into the expo for the first time, if you've been to Funkhaus before, you know, it's like this very grand building. And in the main hall, there was this expo hall. As you can imagine, you know, if you've gone to like a jobs fair or a business expo, it's very much that setup. But the strange thing was that most of the stalls, they had sort of rugs everywhere and bean bags, and there was someone like with a gong, and there was someone trying to do some sort of like rhythmic chanting meditation, but then you're just in this really corporate space. So already it was just so jarring visually what was going on.
Yeah, you said in the article like one of the first things you saw was somebody implanting a chip into somebody else's hand.
Yes. Literally the first talk I walked into, which was the very end of this talk by this, he's a biohacker, and he had a man up on stage. The man was, you can imagine, like t-shirt, chain, suit jacket, sunglasses on, like baseball cap on, looking very stoic as this man just injected something into his hand. And I believe it was something to do with NFTs, which feels a little wild in 2026, or something that you can open doors. I really wasn't sure, but I thought, okay, we're in for an interesting ride.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Was it loud? Like when you walked into the hall?
Yeah.
I'm kind of picturing kind of like a Roman carnival, you know?
Yeah, it was very hushed. Ah. It was very, the main sort of hall in Funkhaus, it used to be this big DDR recording studio, and it's just absolutely massive and grand. And because of that, it doesn't have proper seats. So people are sort of sat on the floor. The lighting is very dim. It feels like you're going to be seeing like a classical concert or something. But instead, there's this man up on the stage with medical equipment. So it was very hushed. But then the second he injected it, everyone erupted into applause. And there was a lot of that throughout the evening. People like impromptu cheering or things like that.
Yeah. You don't get that at the Job Expo.
Get that at the Job Expo.
I guess.
No.
Although at the Green Week, at the Grüne Woche, you can sometimes...
Really?
You can hear... There's like horse races. There's like funny stuff. What question did you go into Trip wanting to answer?
There was a couple of things that I was curious about. The first one was, who is this for? Because it very purposely says on its website that it's for everyone, which leads you to thinking, okay, what kind of people are paying money to get tickets for this event? And then also, what's it doing in Berlin? Particularly with the way it was kind of marketed and some of the people there, it felt very San Francisco techie to me, which does kind of make sense in the direction that Berlin's been going recently. But yeah, I was curious, why is this in Berlin? What is particularly Berlin about this? And then a sort of like broader, more thematic question I was thinking about was, what does it mean when something like psychedelics, and alternative medicine, something that's always been seen as kind of subculture or counterculture, what happens when that becomes the culture or part of the culture? Yeah.
Do you feel like you're satisfied with the answers you got?
Yeah, I think there's not one answer to any of those questions, but it was interesting going to, with the first question, who is it for? It really was for everyone. Like, the main thing I could say taking away was this was the wildest combination of people at an event that I have ever experienced. Because you go in and there's, as I mentioned, the biohackers, sort of what I would call like the Mitter startup final boss. And then there's also proper hippies, you know, white people with dreads doing drumming circles. There's people who are very clearly just there for the psychedelics and on psychedelics wandering around. And then there's people who are trying to take it very seriously.
I always wondered where those people who do juggling at the streetlights, where they kind of congregate.
Do you know what? There was a juggling thing. There was as part of the advertising, it said, break a mental health world record. And then I came across this little sign amongst all of the psychedelic stuff and healing. It was, come at this time and break a world record for juggling.
Right.
There was a juggling man there too. So clearly that's where they go.
All right. Well, let's break down some of those things. I mean, you mentioned sort of the Berlin angle of it all. Mm. What is the like general update on the science and the politics? Is it allowed now to use psychedelics medicinally in Berlin? What's the kind of basic status right now?
So currently it's not allowed, generally speaking. But what has changed in the past, literally within the past year, is that a compassionate use trial has been permitted in Germany. And that's the first of its kind in the EU. So by a compassionate use trial, we mean more than just a randomized control trial or something that's in like a sort of research setting. It means a compassionate use trial basically means, in the case of psilocybin, people who have treatment-resistant depression. So they've exhausted all their other options. There's now sort of one clinic that has been allowed to use psilocybin as a treatment for depression.
This is the Ovid Clinic,
the
right?
The Ovid Clinic, exactly.
In Friedrichshain.
Yeah, in Friedrichshain, exactly.
I mean, I think it's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
I think it's one of these things where Berlin really does feel like there's something interesting happening here and at the forefront.
Definitely.
And I remember when, in 2018, Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, came out. And a few years later, then he wrote This Is Your Mind on Plants. And it brought a lot of the kind of micro-dosey, not just hippies at a fish concert, you know, tripping balls or whatever, this kind of psychonautic, people interested in the brain. And of course, that's people interested in therapy and people interested in productivity and people interested in like peak performance, like Tim Ferriss or whatever would be talking about it. What was your sense there at the conference about Berlin status in that? Like, did you feel like there was it had to be here? Or do you feel like this was something that could be, you said like San Francisco or kind of be anywhere in the world? Or what was Berlin about it?
I think, like you said, I think the practicalities of the fact that this clinic is here in Friedrichshain does make a real difference and kind of gives it that scientific grounding because you're then able, I mean, they show me their research studies that they use in advance And so on that side of things as well, I also think this is something that was brought up in a couple of talks. I think Berlin has that interesting history in general of counterculture.
Yeah.
And someone at one of the talks was saying this is one of the last centers of capitalistic resistance in the world, which might be slight hyperbole in my opinion, but it has that interesting mixture of the real scientific rigor, but then also the history of counterculture and psychedelics more generally, like in West Germany in the 60s as well.
Yeah, and you mentioned the Sandoz. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you say it. Sandoz?
Sandoz, I think, yeah.
You mentioned the Sandoz lab, where a lot of LSD was produced and also not discovered, but like had this kind of Nazi connection, is that right?
Yeah.
So what's the history there, yeah?
Essentially, this is going off of Norman Ohler's talk and some of his book as well. But essentially, Sandoz was the lab where LSD was first accidentally discovered. And that was the lab where Albert Hofmann sort of first accidentally discovered Sandoz. Yeah.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
I didn't put those two together.
Yeah.
With his famous bicycle ride.
With his famous bicycle ride, exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so what is the history that you mentioned in the article with the Nazi connection that Norman Ohler talks about?
Yes. So the Nazi connection is interesting. So as we mentioned, Hofmann, probably have heard of him if you know a little bit about psychedelic history. He is the guy who accidentally discovered LSD, tried some of it and then went on this bicycle ride where he took like a heroic dose by accident of LSD and was just cycling around going, what the hell's going on there? He worked at a lab called Sandoz. And basically what Norman Ohler, who's this historian, discovered by digging into the archives at Sandoz is that the guy who essentially was in charge of Sandoz, I believe, was in regular communication with this German man called Richard Kuhn. And in the 1940s, Richard Kuhn starts working with the Nazis. And the Nazis are, at this time, trying to develop methods of ways of chemically controlling people, trying to create their own mind control drug, essentially, and testing it on people in concentration camps. And he discovered some written communication between these two, between the Sandoz lab and Richard Kuhn. So it's not 100% confirmed, but what you can read between the lines of what they're suggesting is that Sandoz did send over some, I don't think it was lysergic acid, it was the thing that you use to make lysergic acid, to Richard Kuhn.
Okay.
Because they always shared their research together.
Yeah.
So potentially what Ohler argues is this is how LSD got into the hands of the Nazis. And they then begin testing it on people.
And the idea being, because of its connection to the Nazis, becomes part of the argument against the legalization of psychedelic drugs, only this kind of anti-counterculture, long-haired hooligans with their flower power or whatever, but that it also had this Nazi past that was used to justify their prohibition.
Yeah, because to begin with, before this in Sandoz, it was still being treated as a very interesting medicine. And one of the things it talks about is a potential cure for dementia, which Ohler gets into in his book as well, a potential cure for depression, which we're just getting back to now. And essentially what changes is then when the United States hears that the Nazis are using this, then they get hold of LSD, they begin MKUltra, and it becomes kind of a two-pronged. First of all, there's this Nazi associations of it as a mind control drug. Then there's the American associations of it. They think, well, we're going to use this as a mind control drug. And they also get worried at this time because it's the Cold War. They're thinking, well, we don't want the USSR getting a hold of this. So they say, if we're going to have it, we're just going to have it for ourselves. This can't be used in research purposes. We're going to make it a controlled substance, essentially.
It's so interesting that then now, you fast forward to now, and it's like among certain circles also just a piece of optimization.
Or yes.
A tool in the toolkit of self-actualization or high performance or better focus. I mean, okay, so we've talked a little bit about Berlin, but like, you know, one thing I really like in the article is you say it's hard to tell if it's a festival or a conference.
Yeah.
Why does that matter? Like, why is the difference important? I think it is important for Berlin, you know?
Yeah. And I think the organizers of the expo would argue the same thing. They say it doesn't matter. It's all part of the same culture. And the nightlife part of it is part of the conversation, which does make sense in a sense, because when you're thinking about, okay, we're having these conversations about psychedelics, we're coming together to talk about psychedelics, logically, you could say, okay, we're coming together to experience psychedelics together, to move our bodies together, to connect in these ways. I definitely think in theory, I completely understand that. I think in practice, what that means is there's just different people there for different purposes. And particularly as the evening goes on, you then get people who are just there for the... there was a big like psytrance event in the evening. So you get that crossover. And I was speaking to people and they're like, oh, yeah, you know, I'm not going to any of the talks here. I'm just going to party. And yeah, there's a bit of a not so much of a crossover in that respect. But I don't think every single person who comes to this festival has to be pondering the impacts of psychedelics. But it does create a weird setting where, particularly by the evening, there were still talks going on. People trying to take it seriously, but then people who were definitely beginning to party and have been drinking out in the sunshine all day and doing whatever they were doing.
Like, I definitely had the impression reading the article that, you know, Elon Musk famously was turned away at Berghain.
Yes.
He would not have been turned away here, right? There are some of his people here in a big
100%.
Way. And he's a famous mushrooms taker and psychonaut himself or something. You also, tell me more about the kind of people that were there. You talk about someone named Dominic, who comes from, I think, Hanover.
Yeah.
And you said he has this kind of business idea. Okay, great. But you said he's exactly the demographic you keep meeting. So what do you mean?
I think, like you mentioned, I think Elon Musk would definitely have felt at home there. The sort of, what I call them before, the kind of like startup final boss characters. Dominic definitely felt like one of them. Like, he was very, very sweet. We actually ended up spending a lot of time together.
Cool.
But he was just almost like the archetype that you can imagine of the kind of person that was there, in that he was from not even Hanover, a small town outside Hanover, and was very straight edge, worked at Porsche, very corporate. But then he went and he did, I believe it was ayahuasca, and his world was changed, and he discovered that capitalism was bad, actually. And now, by discovering capitalism was bad, he said to me he wanted to fight that by starting a business, which I didn't quite get the logic, but he wanted to create his own thing. And I think there was lots of young men in particular who had started their own business, who perhaps before, and if they hadn't have taken psychedelics, would be leading very archetypal, conservative with a small c lives in Germany. Kind of this joke sometimes women make, that it's like men have to do psychedelics to understand that they should have empathy. And there was some of these people that maybe felt like they were there. Actually, Dominic's business, at least it was not supplements. There was a lot of supplements being sold.
Yeah, there's something, some kind of need to improve physically.
Yes.
Like an external input is the thing that will improve us.
Yeah, that was something I found very interesting. I think the expo kind of created this environment because it was not just for psychedelics, it was for human flourishing, as they called it. And they had a whole stage that was called the longevity stage. They invited all these biohackers in, which is not psychedelics, but in their minds, it feels like psychedelics are part of this self-optimization.
Yeah, or like it's state-of-the-art or something, right? Like
exactly.
It's on the forefront of something.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, just because Dr. Atiyah was in the Epstein files or whatever, that movement seems alive and well and in Berlin. So, but it's a good segue. Like, tell us more about the founder and some of the speakers. And you quote Kevin Capa, I think, a senior advisor.
Yeah.
You know, you said it was like a flourishing conference, but like, what was the goal of it? And how was it positioned? And was this purely a money-making operation? Is it supposed to be scalable? Is it like the Lollapalooza of, you know, of, I don't know, psychedelics or something? What did you learn from kind of how they presented it and what they're after?
Yeah. Essentially, the founder is a guy called Jakob Malkmus, or Jacob Malkmus, I'm not sure. And he is, you know, he's a young guy. He's like in his mid-30s. And he seems like the type of guy who's just always been starting his own little mini businesses. And if you look back through his history, you know, he starts off with health foods, and then he moves into vitamins, and he has that business is still going. At the same time, he also gets involved with running a festival, which they showcase at this expo as well in the evenings. He also gets involved with a CBD company. So it feels like this is something in the positive sense, he's always been interested in.
Yeah. Yeah. How much creatine was there? Protein. What was the protein?
Actually, there wasn't that much protein. There was a lot of matcha.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of cacao, like gentrified cacao is okay. how I could best describe it. With all these claims anyway. But yeah, I guess for them, it makes sense. If this is something he's interested in, if he's got this background in nightlife and in this kind of world, and he's got the funds to do it, I could see why the logical next step would be, let's create an expo. Let's talk about this.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, there doesn't have to be a conspiracy behind this, right? Like, it could be people that think they can sell tickets for this thing because it's interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, but like, how did they manage to position it, I guess, to attract?
Yeah.
Such a wide group of people.
I think the sort of angle that they had, which I think does make sense to me personally, is they said that conversations around psychedelic research and mental health and culture around those fields were already happening. You know, we can think like the scientific, the corporate, the cultural, but they were never happening in the same room. Like the scientists were never speaking to the practitioners, the art and culture side were never speaking to each other. So they were like, let's bring them all together to have these conversations in the same place, essentially.
Did you feel like that happened?
I think there's still a divide. Like when I spoke to the person from the Ovid Clinic, which is the clinic in Friedrichshain, I could tell he was not approving or not like on the same wavelength as a lot of the people, essentially the grifters, to be frank, who were selling this kind of stuff. You know, he said to me, there's a lot of people who are seeing a new kind of gold rush. And I think for people like him, who this has been his life's work and research, it's, you can't really have a conversation with those people because you're just speaking about two different things. You know, he's not speaking about optimizing your life. He's not speaking about business. He's speaking about really trying to make an impact on people who are quite ill. And he's very scientific backed. And I think a lot of the more spiritual side of things, you know, he was a very practical German man. Like, it was just never going to work for him.
Right. Do you think it made money? Do you think it was a success?
It was certainly very busy. And I'd have to look up the prices of the tickets. The tickets were pretty pricey.
Yeah.
And the entire time I was there, it was quite busy. But there was an extra, if you got your VIP ticket, which I got access to for free with my press pass, you got access to this separate wellness section, which was essentially a small strip of grass next to the river with a caravan that was a sauna, some very sort of shoddy ice baths.
Uh-huh.
And I was there and there was just a bunch of naked German men doing press ups. And I thought, if I'd had to pay extra for this, I don't know how I would feel.
It does. Yeah, go ahead.
And yeah, I feel like there was a lot of, you know, the classic, like you can buy it for an extra 50 euros. You can get this. And to go to the club nights, you had to also play extra. So just keeps adding.
And there were some legitimate speakers there, right? I mean, you said William Leonard Pickard was mentioned, right? So who's he and what did you learn from his talk?
Yeah. Or? I mean, he was super, he's a character. And he's definitely, I mentioned in the article, he is kind of a psychedelic celebrity.
Yeah.
So he's the man who's believed to have synthesized at one point, I believe it was 90% of the world's LSD. I mentioned in the article, he speaks with the calmness and the slowness of someone who accidentally took 80 million doses of acid, which he did one time.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah, basically he was trying to, he was synthesizing the acid in the lab and something spilt and it cracked and it poured all over him. And he's, thinks it was about 80 million doses of acid. And he says he's there, he's lying on the floor because he always, when you're doing this, you always work alone because he says it's too dangerous. You don't want to get other people in trouble. So he's alone in the middle of nowhere in the desert. And he runs to the shower. He starts trying to wash it off. And he says in that moment, he's like hearing angel choirs singing and he's seeing and his vision is completely going. And he's thinking, this is the first 1 minute.
Right.
And so he said he just went out and he sat in the desert and just, saw whatever the hell he saw.
Oh my God.
And then he said he just, once that was over, he went back in and he cleaned up and he got back to work.
Were there any other speakers that stand out that maybe couldn't make it into the article?
Yeah, there was also actually quite an interesting talk from someone called Gabriel, who's mm-hmm. from the Psychedelic Society of Berlin, okay. which is essentially like, you know, a society, a club, trying to bring the community back into the world of psychedelics. You can imagine it's a social club, but they meet up and go to the sauna and do mushrooms together. And he was quite interesting because he's actually an anthropologist, and his research is specifically to do with ayahuasca and how is ayahuasca actually practiced in the indigenous communities in the Amazon. And he essentially went on these trips to try to find the most sort of remote tribes that you can that haven't really had so much Western influence and see, wow. okay, how do they practice ayahuasca? And he said what he found interesting is that he went to this village, I can't remember the tribe's name, but it was very, very remote. And he said, interestingly, how they did ayahuasca, it was not in this ceremonial way that, you know, the Westerners get sold and some other tribes do. He said it was very casual. It was like having a beer. He said he'd done ayahuasca with these people and then he was just sat with some of the elders, but then the families were in there. There was kids running about. They were just in the kitchen, like chatting. Mm. And he found that super interesting. He was like, for these people, this is a social thing.
Yeah.
And he wondered whether some of the more ceremonial side we see was potentially to do with tribes that have been a bit more Christianized.
Oh.
And adding that, okay, this is a religious thing rather than like a social thing and connecting with nature. That was his theory. I don't know mm-hmm. how true that was, but yeah, his kind of conclusion at the end of that was, okay, well, in the Western world now, we've sort of got so into this idea of self-optimization and then psychedelics are now being used as part of that. But that's all super individualistic, right? It's like, I'm going to live forever. I'm going to improve my life X, Y, and Z. But actually, if you go back to what psychedelics should be, or he argues should be used for, what they're traditionally used for, is connecting with other people.
Mm-hmm.
It's a community building tool. It's connecting with other people. It's also connecting with nature, right? If you do psychedelics, you feel more in touch with the nature around you. So his argument was, let's try and bring it back to that. Let's bring it back to a place of community rather than endless self-optimization. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, like, in this scene, part of the appeal, and maybe it's with any kind of, I don't know, drug or state-of-the-art, really forefront technology or practice. But like mm-hmm. in both those spaces, like some of the appeal seems like it's being part of a secret.
Yes.
Or being ahead of the curve. But then you have, people talking about it.
Yeah.
And sort of promoting it or mm-hmm. marketing it or wanting to share, I figured this out and everyone else should do this. And it could blow up a spot, or does it matter? Like, is anything at risk? Did you have a feeling of that sort of tension there?
I think so. I definitely think I agree with you. It feels like there was a sense there that was like, okay, from the people I spoke to, like the people who are visiting, what they liked about this was it was a space where everyone understood.
Yeah.
You didn't have to explain yourself. There was that idea of this shared secret. You know, the sense that people aren't going to make fun of you for saying I did psychedelics and it improved my life in X, Y, or Z way. And I did wonder that. I wondered, something like this is essentially, it makes it more mainstream. I don't think that event itself, I think psychedelics are becoming more mainstream.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, one of the people I spoke to was, there's normal people here. It isn't just hippy-dippy weirdos, which is definitely true. But then what is lost by giving that to everyone? And I think for some people I spoke to, it felt more like this is psychedelics are something spiritual, or something countercultural. And so necessarily, actually, they shouldn't be so mainstream because then in that process, that is going to be lost.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, do you have a sense of like the line between cultural appropriation or curiosity and health?
Yeah. I think it was interesting. It was something that I didn't really have the space to write about in the article, but the use of the tribes from the Amazon in this expo.
Right.
So I mentioned obviously the different groups of people there, but there were also some sort of traditional practitioners. There were people from the Amazon who were there in ceremonial dress. And throughout the weekend, they would have these things called rapé ceremonies, which is essentially to do with like tobacco, and they blow tobacco up your nose, massively oversimplifying it. There was cacao ceremonies. And it was something that people who were visiting there were loving, but I found it interesting in this setting that it almost felt like they were being used as set decoration. As like, oh, look, this is, we've got some legitimacy here because right. we have these traditional practitioners doing this stuff. And, you know, everyone was filming them and things like that. And I just wondered, from their perspective, what they would have made of this whole event.
Yeah. Absolutely. I used to subscribe to Double Blind magazine. It's a magazine from the States that's like quite nice print magazine. They also offer courses like mm-hmm. how to trip or microdose, or they often talk about other substances. And but like, it's in the end, it's uncomfortable to feel like you're part of the commercialization or exposure of this private thing or other people's thing. In Double Blind, for sure, you also have this slightly liberal point of view where some of the articles are explicitly about that. We're white people exploring intersectionality and psychedelics, but we recognize the need to respect ancient traditions and threatened communities, but also check it out. There's this very rare frog that you can lick if you go to this one place, but like, we won't tell you where it is, but like, it's called this. And, you know, did you feel any kind of responsibility as a writer in this space? Like, how did you want to balance all of these things also?
Yeah. I think it's a difficult one because I didn't want to go in it. I said to Rufy, I'm not wanting to go in this to try and completely take the piss because I don't, that's not what I believe.
Yeah.
And I think there is the balance between these products, these medicines have had real impact for people. And so I can understand if you have gone to South America and you've experienced something and you think, wow, this has completely changed my life.
Yeah.
You want other people to experience that too. And I think for, you know, even some of the local practitioners, they might be thinking this is, we want to share our knowledge with people. But it does in some ways feel a little bit extractive, the knowledge that kind of, we're just taking things out. And I don't know what we're giving to these communities other than money.
Yeah,
I'm not sure.
What is the current status with these LSD copycats or analogs?
Yeah.
What are they? You mentioned it once, and like, how, what are they? How do they work? Are they the same as LSD? Are they legal?
So there was lots of stands throughout the expo hall. Mm-hmm. Which I sort of wandered over and I was like, are they selling what I think they're selling? Yeah, they are. Mm-hmm. so there was a stand that was selling Amanita mushrooms, which are, I believe, like a type of psilocybin mushroom, which is still technically legal. And then lots of the other stands were essentially selling synthetic versions of LSD, psilocybin, and 2CB. Okay. But they're clear it's not the same drug, obviously, but essentially, particularly with LSD, I could get the name up, it's something, they basically have to keep changing it because they keep criminalizing it. So they have to keep slightly tweaking it.
Right, so they make an analog, like a molecule.
Yeah,
right?
Of a molecule. And so they change one bit from the molecule. Sorry.
And then the EU or Germany or something discovers it and says that this is illegal. It goes through all the regulatory processes. And then whoever's producing it just changes it again and then calls it something else.
Exactly.
But is the effect of it the same? I mean, so it's okay that they were selling it and people were then, I guess, tripping on these LSD copycats.
Yeah, I think so. I believe the one they were selling was 1P LSD, and then the mushroom analog is called 4-promatosin.
Okay.
And yeah, they are able to sell them because essentially they say these are research chemicals that are being used for research.
Uh-huh.
And I got a leaflet from the LSD stand. Let me see if I can find it because they phrased it in quite a funny way. I don't know, it was from May. Where was I? What's been going on? Yes, so they call it, this specific brand is called Fair LSD, and it says, well, Fair LSD is not made for human consumption. It is an experimental substance, and it is your choice how you experiment with it. But if it in some way accidentally finds its way into your body, you should be prepared for LSD-like effects.
Yeah. What would you recommend listeners if they want to get into it? And what should they look to do or look not to do? Or what's a good place to get started?
Yeah. I think, the issue with the synthetic versions of the psychedelics, like the fake LSD, is that when you change one molecule, it's not making that much of a difference, but it can, it makes it just more unstable. Mm-hmm. So often what people report is either it doesn't kick in for a really long time, or it doesn't kick in at all, or it does kick in and it's just extremely stronger or extremely weaker. It's a lot more variable. So actually, if you could find yourself a source of actual LSD and actual mushrooms, that's actually a lot safer than going with these synthetic compounds. The advantage of the synthetic ones is you can buy them online and you're not having to, you know someone or go on these underground routes. But generally speaking, it's better to go with the actual substance. And, you know, a big thing they emphasize, everyone in the psychedelic world knows about this, I'm sure, but like set and setting and the intentions that you go into taking a psychedelic and making sure you're in an environment that feels comfortable for you. So it's interesting people doing it at Trip Expo because it's such a, in terms of set and setting, in some ways it's perfect because it's so bizarre. But if you were on a high dose of psychedelics, it's so jarring, that experience of going from one room to another and sitting in a sort of professional talk 1 minute and then being in a drumming circle the next.
Also, probably the worst thing you could do while really tripping is like run into other people tripping.
Yeah.
I mean, where do you see this all going? Like, will psychedelics be used more?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think from speaking to the person at the Ovid Clinic and actually reading the sort of summary of their studies, they believe that, psilocybin should be legalized, at least in medical use, within the next 5 years.
Yeah.
So I think that's definitely the direction of travel that we're going in. And lots of people that I spoke to at the festival felt like they were at the beginning of another sort of psychedelic renaissance like we had in the 60s. But in this time, it's not counterculture, it's becoming culture. So it does feel like it is becoming more acceptable in a lot of ways. And I think it's interesting in the sort of nightlife world, which I know about, you know, in Berlin at the minute, the big thing is like 3MMC, 4MMC, is these kind of like hard chemicals and you're dancing for ages. And I wonder whether there's going to be like a swing back into thinking some people who maybe done it, pushed it a bit too hard on the those chemical side of things, actually they're moving into psychedelics because it's, I think, kind of objectively better for you than doing some of the other drugs.
Yeah.
So it could become part of that. From my experience in nightlife, it's not something that people are using in nightlife lots, but I do wonder whether if it becomes legalized, it will swing more that way. But yeah, like you said with the Michael Palin, but I think it's interesting that it's, I don't know, from my perspective, it's a good thing that these things are becoming more normalized. And I think, but I think if you've got no experience in psychedelics at all, just being like, oh, I'm just going to start microdosing, like you are still experiencing a psychedelic state.
Yeah.
It's not like taking a vitamin.
Right.
In the same way.
Right. Or drinking coffee.
Or drinking coffee, exactly.
Yeah. And like, there is something also interesting and maybe analogous to Berlin in that you mentioned in the article, it's very, was always considered very counterculturally, mm-hmm. Grateful Dead, mm-hmm. You know, psychedelic man, like that kind of stuff. And now, like Tim Ferriss and like Dr. Attia, these more the manosphere, mm-hmm. This change is real. I wonder if it can be reclaimed or, I don't know, evened out or if that matters.
Yeah, I think sort of what I took away at the end of the weekend was that the festival wasn't, there was a lot of those people that I mentioned and I wrote about them a lot because they're entertaining and I think they're important. Also, it's kind of symbolic of exactly you said, the new direction it's going in. But it wasn't like one conversation was happening at the expo. And actually, there was lots of different kinds of conversations going. And I think there is definitely a group of people who are seeing which way the wind is blowing and are trying to push back against that.
Right.
Because there's nothing worse than having something that you love and enjoy being co-opted by Elon Musk and co. Like, I think, it's always the, with anything that was seen as forbidden, there's something that is gained and something that is lost by making it more mainstream.
Yeah, that's an amazing reflection. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Heist Podcast. I want to say thanks again to Lily Johnson for our good chat. Like I said, I'll link to her full article in the show notes, or you can find it at heistberlin.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode. Until then, you can always send us pitches and ideas. Our email is hello@heistberlin.com. Bye.